Okay.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. Bill says jump, I say hi.
What's that?
Bill says jump, I say how high.
Yeah,
jump. You just make some noise, it's okay.
All right, if you are in the auditorium, if you could come have a seat, we're going to try and start our last presentation before lunch. For those of you who are in here, I think I'm going to start. And I'd like to ask if you have your blue folders, if you could find the yellow piece of paper that's in your blue folders. There's a yellow piece of paper in your blue folder. It says Global Warming Summit on the top, general information. It talks about restrooms, question sheets, and then it talks about lunch. And while people are getting settled, I'd like to just talk about what's going to be happening here at lunch. Again, I think Institute Days are all about trying to find those one or two gems that are going to work for you and do something for you in your classroom when you go back to your classroom. I know I've already picked up more than one gem this morning. But at lunchtime, we want some opportunities for everybody to connect with somebody here. So if you look at the bottom, they have locations for lunch. We do have 500 people coming out of here to eat lunch, so we are going to overwhelm their cafeteria if we all tried to go there. So here are the places we have for you to eat your lunch today. One West. It's located just off the cafeteria. If you go up these stairs, there's a big, you will be able to pick up your box lunches right outside the doors here, and then you can go up into the main Wilson Hall to eat. One West is lecture hall, a smaller lecture hall. It holds about 180 people. If you want to just kind of veg out at lunch, 180 people can fit in there, and Louise Huffman of the University of Nebraska will be showing videos of the Andrill project. It's the Antarctic drilling project from last year, or this just previously. And she'll show all of her videos of the teachers that they had down there and the research that's going on in Antarctica. So if you would like to watch some videos and enjoy lunch and you can, you know, talk to your colleagues at the same time, that's going on there. I'd encourage you at some point to walk through One North. One North is, again, just up here to the left in the main room, and it's a little conference room. So you're not going to be able to go in there and sit there and eat. But at some point, we have Sylvia Peterson from Naperville has come with about six or seven of her middle school kids. And they actually have their science experiments set up. So if you're looking for one or two experiments maybe you can take back to do in your room, here's kids that have actually done them. They're working. They have it there to show you how it works. You can walk around, talk to Sylvia Peterson, the teacher who's done it with their kids, talk to the kids, interact with them. So that'll be up in One North. So, oh, yes. Sure.
Sylvia actually has a set of the materials that Andrill has put together called Antarctica's Climate Secrets. And the materials are based on five themes. One of them kind of Antarctica today, and then ice on the move, and looking at rock cores, which is what Andrill is looking at. Andrill's looking at paleoclimate records, taking the record from the 700,000-year record that Dave was talking about, and taking it back 20 million years through the rock cores. So this is all based on that science and based on understanding the rock cores through looking at the rocks, looking at diatoms like Dave mentioned and things like that. There's banners that are up there. And then the activities that Sylvia's kids are doing are part of that bigger curriculum material packet. It's all going to be available online for free download, or you can order them and have them shipped to you for whatever the price is. Those will be, they're online now, but as of March 17th, I think they actually will be available to buy or to download the final draft. Right now it's in draft form. But you can take a look at them and see what the kids are doing with it. It's kind of I'm pretty proud of it. I think you'll like what you see.
So definitely stop by there. And then the cafeteria, if you can find any space to eat up in the cafeteria is fine, or you can come back here to eat anywhere else you'd like to eat and spend your lunch talking with your colleagues and enjoying some time, that'd be fine. Our next presenter to take us into the lunchtime hour is Jenny Baseman. I had the pleasure to work with Jenny and get to know her over the last couple of years. We've done a couple of things together, and it's been an outstanding experience. Again, local connections. Jenny is a Wisconsin girl. Grew up on a farm up in Wisconsin.
That's what I like to hear.
During football season, we try not to hold that against her.
But
again, one of these, oh, the places you'll go. You know, I think if you looked at my book, Oh, the Places You'll Go, I think maybe I've been to Wisconsin a couple times. But in contrast, Jenny's been to Antarctica. I mean, not many people have stepped on the continent. She is one of these people that has been to Antarctica, but not once, not twice. She's actually been to Antarctica 3 times. She couldn't get back there most recently, so instead she decided she liked the cold so much she actually moved to Alaska. So her current position is she is in charge of the Early Career Scientist Research Associate Network for the University of Alaska and lives up in the Great White North, and she has flown down here just to spend today with us. So this is the sole reason she's here. So without further ado, this is Jenny Baseman.
Thanks, Bill. Can everybody hear me okay? Not used to speaking with a microphone. My story with polar research and climate change is one that I think is kind of interesting. And I was trying to figure out what I was going to talk to you all about today. And Louise, my dear friend and one of my inspirations, said to me, just tell your story. So I'm going to tell my story, but I'm telling it to you as teachers because I think a lot of times, you know, you hear, well, you should be teaching this or you should be teaching that, but what maybe you don't hear often enough is what happens after students leave your classes and the impact that you have on them. I, as Bill said, grew up in Wisconsin on a small dairy farm in a very small community, Marathon City, 1,500 people, very small. I had several, somebody from Marathon? No, can't be. I had several really, really wonderful teachers, and one of them in particular, Mr. Wayne Kleinschmidt, my chemistry teacher, got a grant from the state of Wisconsin to take some students out into the local rivers and measure nitrate concentrations. And growing up on the farm, you often look for as many opportunities as possible that you can do, particularly with school, to get you off of the farm and out of work. And Mr. Kleinschmidt asked me one summer if I would work with him and help him measure some nitrate concentrations in the local streams. And of course, I would rather do that than bale hay. So I took him up on that offer and spent most of the summer walking around with waders in streams and shocking fish and taking water quality samples. And before that, I had no idea that people could actually do that for a living. And I totally fell in love with water chemistry and streams and nature. And so that's kind of how I got my start in science. From there, I went to the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point, which is a small 4-year campus of the University of Wisconsin system, and had another wonderful, inspirational professor, Bryant Brown, who took me under his wing very early on and saw something in me that I didn't think I had, and I'm still not sure I do. But he encouraged me to do research as an undergraduate. And I ended up teaching soil physics as a sophomore in college. I had never had soil physics and still have never had soil physics, but I was teaching this class. And so I don't know how that worked, but so when Frank mentioned before that he was a biology teacher teaching earth sciences, I kind of understand how that works. But so I really got involved with research and science very, very early on. And while I was progressing through my master's and my PhD at the University of Colorado, I had a really wonderful experience, and it was kind of random, I guess. I was taking a class from a woman named Diane McKnight, who just recently wrote a great book that some of you first and second grade teachers should really use for your classes. It's called The Lost Seal, and it's a story that she wrote about one of her trips to Antarctica. And she was teaching this class called Stream Ecology, and said after class that she was going to show some slides of Antarctica. And at this point, I had no idea people went to Antarctica, let alone did research there or anything. So I thought, what the heck, I'll stay. And she kept talking about the ecosystem there and the streams in Antarctica and the organisms that live there and how they can survive. And I was just blown away that things lived there and there were streams, which is what I studied way back in high school. So it was kind of an interesting thing. And after the presentation, I had a bunch of questions for her. And she looked at me and she said, well, you know, in a year and a half, I'm not going to be able to go. If you want to go and take my place, that would be great. And being a person not to ever turn down an opportunity, I said, yeah, sure. No idea what I would get into, especially because I ended up having to take care of the third inspirational teacher in my life, and that was Louise. I was the leader of the LG Ops, I guess, so the group that studied LG in the McMurdo Dry Valleys that year, and we had a teacher with us as part of the Teachers Experiencing Antarctica and the Arctic, the TEA program, and that was Louise. And she probably changed my life more than most of those teachers, and some of my science professors might not be so happy with how she changed it, because I became a lot more interested in education and outreach as well as science. So my path has diverged a little bit from just doing research to doing science as well. And I think one of those moments, besides being with Louise, also happened about 6 or 7 hours into this very long flight from Christchurch, New Zealand to McMurdo. I had no idea what I was getting into. Really had never done most of the techniques for the science that I had to perform. But I remember looking out my small cargo window, quite a ways into the flight, and seeing Antarctica for the first time. And it's hard to describe, but it's one of these few moments that I hope everybody can have in their life. It's one of these, you just get tingles from the top of your head to the bottom of your toes, and your whole perspective on everything changes. And I felt for the first time that I was home, which I know sounds very strange, but if any of you have been to Antarctica in this room, which I don't know, there's a few, I think that's an experience that happens an awful lot when you go there, and the ice sort of gets in your blood, and you become infatuated with polar regions. So I just want to tell you a little bit about one of the areas where I do my research, the McMurdo Dry Valleys. And I want to mention this because a lot of times when we talk about global warming and climate change, we really focus on the ice sheets and you know, some of the life in the ocean and things like that. But there's oftentimes, there's a lot of other, particularly biology, that's forgotten. And one really great advancement in science over the past few years, particularly since the IGY, or the last International Polar Year, is the advancement of molecular techniques. If any of you watch CSI and some of these shows, you hear them mention all the time that they're, you know, measuring the DNA and comparing DNA and doing PCR reactions. And they make it seem very fast and easy, but those techniques are very powerful. And they have allowed us to really advance the understanding of the microscopic world, as well as the larger human beings and things like that. But one of the really neat places that life can survive in this world is the McMurdo Dry Valleys of Antarctica. So we've seen a few maps of Antarctica, and Dave talked a little bit about the West Antarctic Ice Sheet and the East Antarctic Ice Sheet. And McMurdo Station, which is the largest U.S. base. The U.S. has three bases, one on Palmer Peninsula, the South Pole, and McMurdo Station. McMurdo, from the air and from the ground, looks like an old abandoned mining town, really. No plants, no life besides human and a few skuas, and of course, organisms that you can't see, which are my favorite. It's located on an island called Ross Island, and there's also Mount Erebus, which is the world's southernmost active volcano on that island. McMurdo Station is actually right next to the New Zealand Scott Base, and this really helps because we can do a lot of international partnerships pretty easily between the U.S. And the Kiwi groups, which leads to much better and more comprehensive science. The McMurdo Dry Valleys are located about, it's about a 45-minute helicopter ride across McMurdo Sound from the town of McMurdo. And the McMurdo Dry Valleys were only discovered in 1903. So we've only known about them as people for a little over 100 years. So they're still pretty new as far as what we know about them. In 1903, when Robert Falcon Scott discovered them, he called them the Valleys of the Dead. He didn't see any plants or trees or polar bears or anything live and walking around. All he saw were glaciers and streams and rocks and some petrified seals and penguins. So it really looked like a scary, dry, dead place. Of course, now, since we've been starting to study there, mainly since the IGY, we know that in the dry valleys, wherever there's liquid water, there's life. It's just really, really little. The largest creature that lives only on land in Antarctica is a columbula. It's sometimes called a wingless fly. This picture Louise actually took through a dissecting scope, and it was about the size of a pepper grain. They can grow up to be about the length of the tip of your pinky. That's the largest creature that lives only on land in Antarctica. So it's pretty small. There are some small little mites that are red in color. They're about the size of a pinhead, and they live, again, only where there's water, which is along these lake beds in some of the lakes or along some streams. There's nematodes, small little worms. When I give talks to kids, I always say nematodes, and they look at me like, what's that? And then I say, who watches SpongeBob? And then everybody knows what a nematode is. There are some lichens and moss, not very many in the dry valleys itself, but they are there. And then, of course, there's my favorite, microorganisms. And I love talking about this because this is an amazing evolutionary adaptation, I think. This is called a cryaconite. And what happens is in the McMurdo Dry Valleys is part of the 2% of the continent that's not covered with snow and ice. So you can see there's all these sand and rocks. And the katabatic winds come down from the polar plateau at hurricane force, and they blow these sand grains around. So this dark sand grain will land up on top of the white glacier, and the dark sand grain will attract the heat from the sun and melt a small little pool of water on top of the glacier. Any bacteria or organisms that are attached to that one sand grain will begin to grow. This particular cryaconite was about this big. So two fists put together, and it started from one grain of sand. So there's some pretty amazing life that can survive down there if there's liquid water. And of course, no Antarctic presentation would be complete if you wouldn't talk about the wonderful little things you can discover every once in a while. This is Charlie. He's the first penguin I saw in Antarctica, about a year and a half old, little Adelie penguin. He was walking and came up to us while we were doing our research, but he was about 15 miles from the ocean at this point, and these lakes in Antarctica do not have fish in them, so there was nothing for Charlie to eat. And if you remember, I showed you the picture earlier about the valleys of the dead and the petrified seals and penguins. The fate of these creatures as they wander into the dry valleys is often not exactly good. We don't know what happened to Charlie. We still have our hopes that he made it, so we'll just keep our fingers crossed on that. But the real interesting thing that we often don't talk about is this smaller life. We talk about the penguins and the charismatic megafauna, as some of us like to call it. But really, there's some pretty charismatic microfauna in these environments as well. And I work mostly studying the communities that live in streams and how they can survive in extreme environments, Antarctica being one of them. And for the majority of the year, these streams aren't frozen like you would think a stream would be if it's cold. They actually evaporate when the water stops running. When the sun goes down, the water stops running, and the streams evaporate. There's just an indentation in the ground. So anything that's living in there, in those streams, has to figure out how to survive without liquid water. And these algomats, these cyanobacteria, basically freeze dry or dehydrate themselves and spend most of their life just waiting for water. But the really cool thing is that within 20 minutes of the stream starting to flow in the next year, these mats are back alive again and active and breathing. Within 20 minutes. So they spend months in this freeze-dried state. Looks like a dried-up sponge. And then within 20 minutes, they're alive again. One of my grad students, Doug Antibus, just recently took some samples that we had that are 26,000-year-old freeze-dried algal mats. They have not been alive for 26,000 years, and added water to them, and they came back to life. So some really cool organisms in the dry valleys and in Antarctica and in polar regions in general that we really don't know anything about yet. So why do we care about these things? Sure, it's interesting and it's neat. Why do we travel all the way around the world to endure these bitter cold temperatures to work on some small little creatures and do some chemistry and science? And let me tell you, there's a few, I'm just going to give you two examples, and we could go on for days about these things, but there have been a number of organisms found in the polar regions and in some of the colder regions of the terrestrial environment that have what's called an antifreeze protein. And the nematodes, again, that's what they look like. Fish, you obviously know, algae. And then, of course, there's bound to be new species of organisms that we discover as we start to uncover some of these subglacial lakes that are underneath the Antarctic ice sheet. There's all kinds of new things. And we know just from these few examples about something called an antifreeze protein, which actually these organisms possess, and that's what helps them to be able to endure freezing. It stops the ice crystals from forming inside of their cells. And these antifreeze proteins can have some pretty important impacts for human society as well as for the animals. Organ transplants, for example, we all know how important it is to register as an organ donor. These antifreeze proteins can actually be used to preserve these organs longer, which can be great. And another extremely important use for these antifreeze proteins is to help with ice cream. If any of you you have your ice cream in your freezer and it starts to grow hair if you don't eat it fast enough, the antifreeze proteins can actually stop that hair from growing on your ice cream. So that's another very important use. One other example, Bill mentioned the ozone hole this morning, and a couple other people did as well. We all know it's a problem. We all know why ozone is important. It stops the UV damage, or UV rays from damaging our skin and causing skin cancer. One thing we probably don't think about is that the organisms that live underneath this ozone hole have to be able to repair their DNA from damaged skin, from the sun's damage, because they can't go out and buy sunscreen. So there are some researchers who are looking at algae that live in the Southern Ocean, trying to harness those proteins that they use to repair their DNA and use them to treat skin cancer. So those are just two examples of great things we can learn from life that exists in the polar regions. The problem is that the polar regions are changing so fast that we don't even know what's there to begin with. And we really need to put more energy, and that's why the International Polar Year is so important, because we're really expanding the amount of knowledge that we have about the polar regions and what we can learn about these areas before they're all gone. So for all you biology teachers out there, and I know there's quite a few of you, there's a lot of things you can do with climate change and biology too, besides the charismatic megafauna. Recently, there was a new species of killer whale, actually, if you want a charismatic megafauna. New species of killer whale discovered in Antarctica. It's the dwarf species, and it's actually gray and kind of a tan color instead of black and white. Really interesting creatures. Krill, of course, are incredibly important to the Antarctic food chain, and they're affected a great deal. I'm sure Martin will talk a little bit later about the Arctic tundra and how that's changing plant life. Diatoms, we mentioned before, and these microorganisms, these algae and these bacteria that we were talking about. Climate change definitely affects all of those organisms, and so biology is important, and I just want people to remember that. It's not just about ice. Here's my third favorite teacher in the world, doing her favorite job, which was measuring rocks in the streams in the McMurdo Dry Valleys. I think it was about this point in time, after she had measured probably about 200 of them in one day, said, "Why am I doing this?" I know she always wanted to go to Antarctica, and for me it was just an exciting opportunity. But one of the things that maybe Louise doesn't know, but one of the hidden benefits of her being there was how she affected the young scientists on our team. We were all graduate students at that point, and there was one guy who worked at the USGS, and Louise. And she was the teacher, and we were the scientists, but we were young researchers, and we were all kind of learning about this Antarctic environment together. And we would do the science during the day, all of us together as a team. And then at night, we would come home, and Louise would do these amazing journals to the students in various classes all over the country, and some, I think, all over the world. And she would tell them about the research that we were doing during the day. And she would explain it in such a way that, you know, my parents would read the journals and they'd be able to understand it. And no offense to my parents, of course. I should have said my brothers. My brothers could read it. No. But so one thing Louise did do for our whole team, and myself in particular, we've been working together now for a long time. Louise inspired me to go into classrooms. And at first, I just started with her classroom and her school, and then I eventually branched out, and I'm doing schools all over the world. I just go into the school and tell them about my science, and I get rejuvenated from that. So the scientist really benefits, and I know how important it is for the students to see a real live scientist, as Louise calls me, and particularly, you know, one that's not a guy and maybe a little bit younger and doesn't, well, I have crazy hair, but you know. And from that outreach came my other passion about, and that's talking about climate change. And I'm one of Al Gore's climate project foot soldiers, I guess. And so that I go around and I do a lot of this education and outreach and trying to explain science to people who, you know, don't have PhDs. And in particular, one of the things that I think is really important is getting science into classrooms and telling students and teachers about science. And this is 4 points that Louise came up with that I like to use because I think they're very important. And their first one is to get your students to actually ask the experts. I know a few times Louise gathers her students and she's talking about something in class like climate change. If the students have a question, she'll ask a scientist. She'll have them email the scientist. But she always puts up this little rules for teachers to make sure that the questions your students are actually sending the scientists are real meat questions and not just tell me about climate change. Because as a scientist, I wouldn't answer that question because, you know, there's so much you could tell. But if they do research first and, you know, they really get into it and they have some specific questions, then the teachers can point them into the directions of which scientists to talk to. And I know a lot of times you have difficulties connecting with those scientists, and I'll get to in a few minutes one of the neat things that's coming up in the next year or two that'll make connecting to scientists a lot easier. Another thing that's really a great way to get science into the classrooms is to have students do parallel studies. So here again we have Louise collecting water samples in the McMurdo Dry Valleys, and at the same time, students in Naperville, her school, were analyzing their local streams as well and comparing the data between these two areas. And that's a really great thing to do, and the scientists don't mind it. Most of us don't anyway. And of course, there's scientists coming into the classroom and visit. A lot of times you can pretty easily convince young researchers to come in because a lot of us, I think, were influenced by education and outreach, and we still remember how much fun it is sometimes to go in and talk to science or talk to classrooms. And some people are even lucky enough to get the star of the International Polar Year to come into their classrooms. Louise gets Dave to come into her classrooms. And there's a lot of scientists that actually are very happy to go in and do that. Nice. But one of the other great things, and probably the ultimate, is having the teachers and the students actually doing the research. There are a few programs that were mentioned already today, and I'm just going to go through those briefly. But there's the GLOBE program, which Frank mentioned, which actually it provides teachers with training on how to do the science. It provides you with the course materials to use in your classroom. It provides you with the actual science materials to, say, collect the water samples or whatever. It's a really great program, and there's a one that's part of the IPY, and it's called Seasons and Biomes. And it's part of it is done in conjunction with the University of Alaska Fairbanks and some of my colleagues. And it's a really wonderful program that's really illustrating how the Arctic and the polar regions are changing because of climate change. Another one that's kind of fun is by NASA, and it's called the Global Snowflake Network. And you go on and you can register, and actually this can be done by anybody. It doesn't just have to be a student or a teacher. And you actually, if it snows in your area, you just record what the snowflakes look like. And they're collecting some really interesting information and learning more about the optical properties of snow and all kinds of fun physics and things. But it's all being done by you and I, like normal, well, I'm not normal, but by citizens of the world. So it's some really neat, interesting stuff. And then there's the great things, which are the teacher immersion programs. Louise just mentioned before the ARISE program and some of the great things they're doing. One of the really cool things I think about the ARISE program is all these different institutions from all over the world that are involved. So we've got teachers in classrooms connecting automatically because the scientists are international. So you've got this great international collaboration, and they're all learning about each other. They're learning the science, but they're also learning the cultures of the other countries, and sometimes that can be just as effective as the science that they learn. And I know for me, doing international work has been invaluable. There's also another great program which is run by the Arctic Research Consortium of the U.S., which is an institution that I work for, and it's called Polar Trek. Polar teachers researching and teachers and researchers exploring and collaborating. And it's another one of these immersion programs, and they take about 12 teachers a year. And I actually brought some brochures on this program and some bookmarks for you all to take home if you're interested in this program. And this one is particularly great because it provides a sustainable environment for teachers. So they talk to each other every month, and they don't just have these experiences and then go off and they're done. They keep continuing to talk to each other, and they have these great events called Live from IPY, which any school anywhere in the world can join. And you can listen to the scientists and the teachers give presentations. So you can bring it up from the internet in your classroom and join and listen to these live presentations. And it's really a great way to bring in a little extra and new science and scientists to your classroom if you can't get an actual scientist to physically be in your classroom. The other fun thing that I'm very excited about and very, I think, will really shape the future of polar research is the Youth Steering Committee, which is a project of the IPY, which has now recently changed its name and merged with some other groups, and we're called the Association of Polar Early Career Scientists. It's really just because we have a cool name, or a cool acronym, APEX. But our tagline is Shaping the Future of Polar Research, and I believe Dave Carlson came up with that for us, but it's kind of a daunting task, but we're starting small. The point is that we realize early in our careers that we want to understand not only international and not only interdisciplinary science. So, you know, I, as a biologist or engineer, really need to understand social sciences because the environment affects humans and humans affect the environment. So interdisciplinary work is extremely important. So these system science things that people talk about is really, we all have to have a grasp on that to really understand our environment. The other thing is the international part. I have learned so much in the past 2 years. Bill mentioned, the places you'll go. And you go to these places for a science meeting. It's all in English. And you're like, why is it in English? That's not fair. I should have to learn some other kind of foreign language. But you're learning about the cultures of these areas and the different ways that their science programs work. And you become this international community of researchers that are connected very early in our careers, and we will go and we'll grow and we'll become professional, you know, scientists together. And I think we'll be able to really push forward science. And one of the main goals of APEX is to actually do a lot of outreach and to go into classrooms and to work with teachers. And there's projects going on all over. You saw the neat little video that Dave showed this morning from the Portuguese Youth Steering Committee. There's a polar contests are being held in New Zealand where young researchers are going into classrooms and working with the students to design these polar activities, and then the winner of the contest of the whole country got a trip to Antarctica. And there's some really, really interesting projects that are going on, getting young scientists into the classroom. But another thing that we're working on right now is we're bridging the gap, I think, between scientists and and polar researchers, or researchers in general. We're working with the Polar Trek. They have a great network for teachers. It's called the CARE Network, and any teacher can join that. It's tons of resources and lesson plans and things like that, and all this information. My presentation is not on your CD, sorry, but it will be on the website after this meeting. But the CARE Network is a great place for teachers to go to share with each other on what things about this lesson plan worked, what things didn't, what do you do with this age group that you can't do with this age group, things like that. And what APEX is trying to do now is to work with them and join our databases, if you will, so that teachers can actually email the young scientists and they can have these interactions together all the time. So if you have a question and you're working on a curriculum development, or you're reading some of Frank's climate literacy and you don't quite understand a concept, or your students ask you a great question that you maybe just don't understand, or you want to know the latest science to, APEX will be there for you to ask a question to. And we'll be able to answer those questions for you. And since we're an international organization, we're up all the time. So anytime, day or night, you'll be able to reach a young scientist. And so there's some really great possibilities there. And I think we're going to raise a new generation of young scientists, myself included, that really believe in working with students and teachers and getting research into the classrooms. And hopefully we'll get a more science literate public in years to come, which, as Frank mentioned, is extremely important right now. One thing I do want to show you is what can happen when you let young researchers create education and outreach materials. And this one I had to include for Dave because he's an oceanographer, but also for Frank because he works for NOAA.
Yo, DIC, let's kick it. All right, stop. Grab a net and a niskin. We're on station. It's time to go fishing. Someone's peeking over the railing. Hurry up, because my battery is failing.
Will this ever stop?
Yo, I can't guess. Turn off the pumps. Let's mock Ness.
To the extreme, the damn boat is rolling. Put it in gear. Let's go plankton trolling.
Damn! Got Nessie in the water. We lost communication. I may have to solder.
Restart!
But this motion's formal. Anything less than success is normal.
Change it or leave it. Check the baud rate.
You better have data bits set at 8. Communication problems, yeah, we'll solve them. Check out our depth, it's dragging on the bottom.
Cruise, cruise, baby. Cruise, cruise, baby. Cruise, cruise, baby. Cruise, cruise, baby.
Now that the ethanol's cranking, with the jars all full, we're preserving plankton. Quick from a point to our station. Slashing up water like our name was Jason. Hurry up, if you aren't quick, you're losing. The bunks will be full of people's news. And we finish all the nets with ease. The pump is off, it's time to catch Z's.
Sleeping
in the bunks below, with my hat pulled down so my eyes don't show. The crew is on standby, waiting for the next try.
Did they sleep?
No, they just drove by. Wake up, RPMs just dropped. 10 minutes left, we should be heading to the next stop. It's just a whale, yo, so we continue to WB.
Wilkinson Basin!
Seas were high and the wind was worse. The boat was drifting, put it in reverse.
Profiler!
Hanging out on the line. Bottles are on like grapes on a vine.
Waiting
for the bottles to drop. Suddenly we hear the gear slamming in the prop like gunshots. And we thought, oh hell. Now the instrument's resting on the shelves.
Data
being collected on the bottom. The niskins are full, but we don't got them.
70 grand sunk into the black.
We gotta pick it up before the storms come back.
Grapple on the scene.
You know what I mean? We pulled it up and we cheered like teens. Instrument problems? Yo, we'll solve it. Check out our buoy. A lobsterman's got it.
Cruise, cruise, baby.
Nothing goes stale. 5,000 calorie minimum. Are those cookies open yet? Cause if not, I'm getting into them. You need a stomach of steel, or you'll be on the railing for real. A 12-hour cruise is a hell of a concept. You might get ill, so head up on deck.
Seasick,
feeling sick at sea. If you wanna feel better, stand under a tree.
Pew fest.
Other people say damn. Take some Dramamine, like 50 milligrams. Keep a slim figure when we go on a cruise. Eat a big lunch so we've got one to lose. Motion sickness problems, yo, we'll solve them. Throw up our snacks, let the ocean dissolve them.
Yo, man, let's get out of here. Word to your photons.
So I think you get the point on... The credit for that actually goes to some young scientists at the University of New Hampshire who were on an oceanography cruise. And I realize that technology is changing and times are changing, and, you know, students have iPods and iPhones and whatever. They also have YouTube, of course, and they're learning in very different ways, I think, than even I did. And you guys know this better than I do, but I do know the effect of things like this that can have on children or students or you guys, for as a matter of fact. I heard quite a few of you laughing, probably because you recognize the song. But you can see that in 4 minutes, or a little under 4 minutes, which is what this video did, you actually saw the life of an oceanographer and learned a lot and a lot of different research things. And so 4 minutes that you can throw into a classroom and you can really learn a lot. And the young researchers today, there's actually the University of Alaska Young Researchers Group are putting together a contest for other young researchers and undergraduate students to put together these, you know, what's it like to live in Alaska type of videos. And there's other programs going on around the world to, you know, contests on students producing videos about their science. So these types of things are going to become, I think, a little bit more important and a little bit better quality and more of them in the future. And they're a really neat, quick research or a quick educational tool to show that. Some other important resources, and all this will be on the website. One organization is called Global Warming 101, and it's run by Will Steger, who does a lot of Arctic, in particular, exploration and trips to learn about things. And they host some teacher workshops and do a really good job at educating teachers on climate literacy. And they have a great website that's both geared toward teachers and young researchers, and there's lots of lesson plans and what grades they're tailored to. And so a lot of them actually are also mention the standards and which ones. So from Frank's Literacy Guide, you can actually go to Global Warming 101 and find some lesson plans to use for those. Taking It Global is something for your students. It's an international organization that tries to network youth and empower youth. And by youth, I mean K through 12, not the global youth, which is sometimes a little bit older, but the K through 12 and some undergraduates, I think, are members of this organization as well. But they're starting a climate action group. So if your students are wondering what they can do to help, they can go to Taking It Global and join their climate action group. And there's a lot of nifty activities that they have provided that you can do in your communities. IPY Days, as Dave mentioned before, the one coming up in March is Changing Earth, and the one coming up in June, which will be particularly spectacular, is sorry, I'm coordinating, but is Land and Life, which obviously is something that is important to me, and it will include some of the biology. And I realize it's in June, and a lot of schools won't be in session any longer, but those resources will always be available on the IPY website, so you'll be able to pick those up in fall when your classes start again. And then, of course, which were mentioned before, blogs from research groups in the field, which can be found on IPY.org, and then, of course, the wonderful YouTube videos. One other resource that isn't too old, but it's one of the reasons why I'm here today, and I was working with Louise, and she put me in touch with Bill, who had this great idea about because if everybody's doing something to help slow global warming, but sometimes you feel all alone. So big deal if I change my light bulbs if my neighbor doesn't. And sometimes you kind of feel like you're all alone. So we've started this program called the Decade of Ed, the Decade of Environmental Decisions. Ed is actually a real guy. It's Bill's nephew. And you'll see a little video of him in a few seconds here. But the Decade of Ed, basically you go on and you become a member, or you log in, and you pledge what you're going to do. So I went on and I said, I'm going to change my light bulbs, and I'm going to use the dryer half the time. That's it. And that's what I'm going to do, and that's what I've been doing. And Louise went on and said what she was going to do, and Bill, and 159 other people so far. And together, we've saved almost 500,000 pounds of carbon going into the atmosphere, which doesn't seem like much when you really look at some of these numbers, but it helps you feel like you're not alone sometimes and that you're actually part of something bigger. And I think that's the real important part of the decade of ed. And kids can do it, and they can go on and say, okay, I'm going to make my parents do this, or try and make my parents, I guess. So I just want to finish today with the message from Bill's nephew, Ed, hopefully.
My name is Ed. I'm a regular guy born and raised in Chicagoland, and I never really saw anything wrong with the way life happened here. By the time I was 24, I realized that something wasn't right. Something had to change. A few months later, I woke up in a small village in Kenya, East Africa. When I came back to America, 3 years later, nothing looked the same. I guess it required removing myself from the life I had always known in order to gain perspective. I became used to walking down a road and passing people instead of cars. I stopped producing so much trash and started reusing things. I bought things only when I needed them. I started thinking about where my food came from, how resources are used, and my impact on the land and the environment. In Kenya, I was living like most people. Here in the United States, suddenly I was different. So I started to see things differently. I saw a sea of cars, big, huge cars traveling on pavement and through neighborhoods that used to be our farmland and countryside. I saw thousands of trucks carrying food and merchandise all across the country. I saw millions of gallons of petroleum burning away. I saw huge trash cans filled to the brim every week. I watched Kenyans carry their own water from a well, and here I watched perfectly good water flushed away. The majority of the world lives like Kenyans. America and the other industrialized nations have a small minority of the world's population, yet we consume the most resources and make the most exhaust and the most garbage. America makes so much exhaust that we're actually ruining the very atmosphere that keeps us alive. I realized I could control many of my day-to-day activities. Every day there are hundreds of small environmental decisions that can add up and reduce my consumption and my waste. Once I started to look for them, I could see them everywhere. I also realized that it's incredibly hard to follow through on all the positive environmental decisions I saw around me. You just can't wake up one day and not use your car. The system in place right now is wasteful because it keeps people separate. People living separately consume, waste, and drive more. Living separately makes life hard as well as wasteful. Living and making environmental changes together makes life easier as well as more efficient. Everyone needs help to make changes. So I made two lists. One stating the positive environmental decisions I've made, and another stating the changes I'm still trying to make. I'm just a normal person with a busy life, and I quickly counted 20 simple environmental decisions I've already made. I was also humbled by all the changes I still need to make. As an incentive for myself to make more changes and to bring more people together in the movement, I have a challenge. As people join the Decade of Ed, I'll make the changes I wrote on my list, like putting up a clothesline or buying a more fuel-efficient vehicle. I'll continue to make more environmental decisions as more people continue to come together. However, everyone who joins has to make the same challenge to others. Everyone should make some simple environmental goals and commit to those changes should more people join the Decade of Ed. All of us can describe the changes we've made on the Decade of Ed website. Remember, the more people who start to make daily environmental decisions, the easier it becomes for others to do the same. We can't change on our own. But together, we'll make a serious positive impact on our environment.
And if you notice right now, there's 159 people registered, so that's divisible by three. So apparently this spreading by three is working, which is great. So something you can all do tonight to help save the, or to help us save the polar regions in particular and help us learn more about some of these crazy antifreeze proteins and these amazing organisms that can remain freeze-dried for 26,000 years and then come back to life within 20 minutes is to join the Decade of Ed and start conserving your resources as well as start educating your students and creating a more climate-literate society. So thank you very much for letting me share my story.
Well, what a great morning. I don't know about you guys, but that was phenomenal. And there's more coming in the afternoon. So.